Our Bible reading this morning is Psalm 104. You'll find this on the inside of the information sheets, and it actually starts down the lower left-hand corner. So from verse 1. Bless the Lord, O my soul. O Lord my God, you are very great. You are clothed with splendour and majesty, covering yourself with light as with a garment, stretching out the heavens like a tent. He lays the beams of his chambers on the waters. He makes the clouds his chariot. He rides on the wings of the wind. He makes his messengers winds, his ministers a flaming fire. He set the earth on its foundations so that it should never be moved. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke they fled, at the sound of your thunder they took to flight. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place that you appointed for them. You set a boundary that they may not pass, so that they might not again cover the earth. You make springs gush forth in the valleys, they flow between the hills. They give drink to every beast of the field, and the wild donkeys quench their thirst. Beside them the birds of the heavens dwell. They sing among the branches. From your lofty abode you water the mountains. The earth is satisfied with the fruit of your work. You cause the grass to grow for the livestock and plants for man to cultivate, that he may bring forth food from the earth and wine to gladden the heart of man. Oil to make his face shine, and bread to strengthen man's heart. The trees of the Lord are watered abundantly, the cedars of Lebanon that he planted. In them the birds build their nests, the stork has her home in the fir trees. The high mountains are for the wild goats, the rocks are a refuge for the rock badgers. He made the moon to mark the seasons, the sun knows its time for setting. You make darkness, and it is night, when all the beasts of the forest creep about. The young lions roar for their prey, seeking their food from God. When the sun rises, they steal away and lie down in their dens. Man goes out to his work and to his labour until the evening. O Lord, how manifold are your works! In wisdom you have made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. Here is the sea, great and wide, which teems with creatures innumerable, living things both small and great. There go the ships and Leviathan, which you form to play in it. These all look to you to give them their food in due season. When you give it to them, they gather it up. When you open your hand, they are filled with good things. When you hide your face, they are dismayed. When you take away their breath, they die and return to their dust. When you send forth your spirit, they are created, and you renew the face of the ground. May the glory of the Lord endure forever. May the Lord rejoice in his works. Who looks on the earth and it trembles, who touches the mountains and they smoke. I will sing to the Lord as long as I live. I will sing praises to my God while I have being. May my meditation be pleasing to him, for I rejoice in the Lord. Let sinners be consumed from the earth, and let the wicked be no more. Bless the Lord, O my soul. Praise the Lord.
Thank you, Richard. It's these little fellas in verse 18. Rock badgers. Nothing to do with badgers, but everything to do with rocks. They live in little colonies in the rocky hills of Palestine, just like in verse 18, and they are nothing to do with rabbits, even though King James translators translated them as conies, poor chaps. You know, what were English translators at the beginning of the 1600s supposed to know about wildlife in Palestine? especially these rock badgers. There are only four species of them in the world, and they're spread out through Africa and the Middle East, hiding out in cliffs and sleeping a lot. And in case we've all just decided that we want to take home a pet one now, be warned, they do not come in ones. They are sociable little beasties, so be ready to turn your whole backyard into a rock badger colony. But it's not the rock badgers in verse 18 that bother me here. They are just part of the great spread of creation in this psalm. The one that bothers me, is the lion in verse 21. The young lions roar for their prey, seeking their food from God. Are we really supposed to think of lions roaring and coming along to their food bowl in the evening like little pussycats for God to give them their dinner? You know, when I was a student studying animals and things, we had to work over the skulls of the big cats, leopards and tigers and lions. And lions are formidable. Not just the great big canines up front, but the molars. You know, razor sharp does not do them justice. Razors are flimsy little things that break and snap if you try to use them for anything heavy. These are more like garden shears, with anchor points for great big muscles to slam them down hard. And we know what they do when they go seeking their food. Lions, they use intelligence. They hunt in groups. They pick out the zebra that they want to go for and they stalk it through the grass. They spring and they bring it down. And then the lioness with those mighty jaws gives the zebra one colossal bite to the neck that crushes its windpipe. It is fearsome stuff. So in verse 21, does our writer not know that? Are these Israelites living so far away from any lions that they think that, oh, God just feeds them? Well, if it's David, we know that David had intimate dealings with lions. In 1 Samuel 17, he talks about keeping the lions off his father's flock back in his shepherd days. In fact, it wasn't until New Testament times when the Romans came that the Roman need for lions in the circus drove lions to extinction in Palestine and Syria. But all through the Old Testament, lions are a scary part of Israelite life. So, how can we have verse 21? Or worse still, combine it with verse 27, with lions and everything else looking to God to feed them? Lions catch their own food. What has God got to do with it? Well, take a look at this psalm. Now, it is a song, isn't it? It's a great big Israelite poem in the Bible, taking us on a trip through the created universe and saying, look at all these created things. Isn't God fantastic? And watch two things there straight away. First, this is a tour. You know, it's like one of those five-day packages to China. Today, Hong Kong. Tomorrow, the pandas and the pinnacles. Tuesday, Shanghai. Wednesday, Beijing. And 4 hours queuing to get into the Forbidden City. Thursday, Hong Kong again and go shopping. Whoosh! Our psalm is taking us for a quick trip just like that. It is not telling us everything. It's just a lightning dash through creation. And second, this is an Israelite song. It's a poem. It's in verse. It's not like some bit of Romans in the New Testament, carefully explaining all the parts of an idea. No, this is a cascade of pictures to appeal to our imaginations and our feelings. And it's an invitation. It's an invitation in song to come with the psalm writer and celebrate God's universe and celebrate God for making it. And from that point of view, Psalm 104 is like standing on North Head on one of those fantastic, windy, rainy days and getting absolutely soaking wet and watching the waves crashing in and being deafened by the wind and saying, isn't God just fantastic to make all this? And the psalm does that by parading word pictures in front of us and letting us just enjoy them. Now, at this point, I am entirely fed up with saying the writer of the psalm. Trouble is, this psalm comes to us anonymous. The Bible doesn't say who wrote it. But look at verse 1. Bless the Lord, O my soul. O my Lord God, you are very great. And then picked up again in verse 35. Bless the Lord, O my soul. Now that is so much like the psalm that comes just before it in the Bible. Psalm 103 starts off, bless the Lord, O my soul, and all that is within me, bless his holy name. And Psalm number 103 is King David. But even more than that, Psalm 103, we were looking at it together last week. Psalm 103 is all about how God saves you and he brings you his forgiveness and he shows you his mercy and he brings you hope when you had nothing left to hope for. And Psalm 103 is all about the biggest ideas in the Bible and all the things that the New Testament says that we have through Jesus. Psalm 103 is rejoicing in being saved. And Psalm 104, this psalm, Psalm 104 does not mention any of that. But Psalm 104 makes the perfect companion to it. Psalm 104 is talking to a saved person who is already forgiven by God, talking to a saved person who loves God and saying, see this universe? This is the universe that your Saviour has made. Look at how great it is. And the two poems make such a perfect pair that I'm going to say that they are both written by David and that they're meant to go together. But this one could have been written by someone else to go with David's Psalm 103. So when I say David, just put that in inverted commas. You know, it could have been written by Asaph or Solomon or one of the others. Who knows? And David parades creation in front of us, very much like the beginning of Genesis. So verse 2, he starts off with letting there be light. And verse 6 down to verse 9, David gives us God separating the sea and the land. And verse 13 down to verse 17, there is the vegetation. But where we read Genesis and it's a bit poetic, David's full of it here. So verse 2, God clothes himself with light. Verse 7, God rebukes the waters and they flee. Verse 10, God makes the springs gush forth in the valleys. It's a poem full of energy and abundance about a creation that is just bursting with life. And it is intensely personal too. David, as we read this, David can't seem to make up his mind whether he's talking to God or whether he's talking to us about God. So, verse 1, you are clothed with splendor and majesty. He's talking to God there. Verse 3, he lays the beams of his chambers. He's talking to us there about God. David keeps flipping back and forth in his joy at this stuff. Talking to God, talking to us. Talking to God, talking to us. His English teacher will mark him down for that. Or maybe his Hebrew teacher will mark him down. Now, because of the kind of poem that it is, all I want to do this morning is highlight three things. Three background ideas that come through this psalm and shape David's thinking. And I really want to leave the psalm itself to encourage us to see God's creation as exactly that. God's wonderful creation. Now the first idea is in verse 1. Bless the Lord, O my soul. Now, it doesn't quite come through the translation, but that is God's personal name, Yahweh, the person who saved the Israelites when they were slaves in Egypt. It is his creation that we're talking about. And that is really important. See, I mentioned David and then I put him in inverted commas, but even then, since the early 1900s, a lot of people say that David stole this one. Way, way, way back in the 1300s BC, more than 300 years before David, the king of the Egyptians was Pharaoh Akhenaten. That is Nefertiti's husband, Tutankhamun's dad. And old Akhenaten in the 1300s presides, he is king over an extraordinary time in Egypt. They've got art and culture and foreign relations and all kinds of fascinating stuff around King Akhenaten. But the one that he goes down famous for is religion. Akhenaten was a sun worshipper. And he shifted great chunks of Egyptian religion to one god, Aten, the great golden sun. Priesthood, temples, rituals, poetry, lots and lots of sun worship in the time of Akhenaten. And you know, because it gets all over the place, whether you are interested in ancient Egypt or whether you couldn't be bothered with it, you know that since the 1900s, in books and on telly and online, they say, oh, Akhenaten was the first monotheist. He was the first one who said there is just one God. And you hear that and straight away you think, what about Abraham? He came before Akhenaten. Yes, but did Abraham believe that there was only one God, or that God was just supreme over lots of other gods that might be there? It's not always easy to read Abraham's mind. Mind, it is really hard to read Akhenaten's mind on that one too. Did he think that Aten was the only God there was, or that Aten was the chief God, or that Aten was an avatar of an even greater God? It's not clear. But that gives rise to all sorts of questions. If Akhenaten was a one God kind of guy, what influence did he have? If any influence, what influence did he have on the Old Testament and the Israelites? The Israelites were part of his world. Or more interestingly, this psalm. Akhenaten had a poem. He may even have written it himself. There it is. Akhenaten had a poem in praise of the god Aten, and he talks about a lot of the same things as our psalm. And his poem is older than David's by 300 years. Sigmund Freud was really big on this. So was my old biology professor at university. Akhenaten, they say, Akhenaten wrote his poem first, 300 years earlier, and then later on the Israelites pinched it and they bunged it in the Book of Psalms. And Freud even wrote a book on this, Moses and Monotheism. I read it years ago when I was studying psychology. It was primitive times and there was a lot of Freud around in those days. And jolly peculiar it was too. But did David pinch Akhenaten's poem? Did he, like someone trying to write an essay that's due in 1 hour's time, nick it and change a few words and kind of file off the serial numbers and change the license plates and give it a respray and then sell it in the Book of Psalms as, look at the poem I've written? Well, if you want to, you can judge that one for yourself. I've got some copies of old Akhenaten's poem, and later on, if you want, take a look and compare it to the psalm and work it out. If you were David's teacher, would you fail him for plagiarism? Mind, even if David did pinch bits from the Pharaoh, even if he did, look at what he's done with it. Akhenaten's song is all addressed to the sun, saying things like, when you are risen on the eastern horizon, you have filled every land with your beauty. Or, your rays suckle every meadow. When you rise, they live, they grow for you. And so on. It is sun worship. Like people down at Bondi right now. It's what Paul talks about in Romans chapter 1 when he says they worshipped and served the creature rather than the creator. Now, compare that with the psalm and verse 2. And in the psalm, we've got Yahweh the Creator stretching out the heavens like a tent. And down in verse 19, the sun and the moon, they are things that he has made. And he gives the sun and the moon their instructions. And David makes a massive distinction between creator and creation. And the thing that is unique about God is he is creator. Everything else is creation. That is a fundamental and far-reaching ontological dichotomy. That is, it is a crucial philosophical distinction. That is, it is a big difference. Creator, creation. There is God himself, the person, the Saviour, and there is the marvellous catalogue of things that he's made, and they are all different from him. And I don't think Akhenaten gets that. But that's the first thing in this psalm. It's all God. He is creator. Everything else is creation. Second thing to notice, in all this wonderful creation, there is nothing to threaten God. He is not in danger from any rival. What do I mean? Well, in the ancient world where they lived, there's this idea that forces of good and evil are almost evenly balanced. The light side, the dark side. Good and bad powers. And in the world of ancient Israel, they will symbolize the evil powers in poetry in all sorts of ways. Chaos, darkness, monsters. Now, there is a name for thinking like that. It's a kind of dualism, two things battling each other for the cosmos. Ever get a bit of that in the 21st century? But see what the psalm does with that. David knows that there is evil in the world. Psalm 103 was all about needing to get forgiven. So David knows about the evil in human life, and he knows about the darkness deep within himself. But the things that get spelled out, the things that for these ancient people, the things that spelled out for them evil powers, the things that for these ancient people they thought of as a kind of evil threat to the gods, look at them. Verse 26, Leviathan. Now, in the songs of the old Canaanites, Leviathan, they imagined Leviathan as a great seven-headed monster, the embodiment of chaos and evil. And Leviathan threatened all order and all human life, and Leviathan terrified the gods. And the god Death in the old Canaanite stories, the god Death sent the god Baal on a mighty quest. And only Baal was strong enough. And in a great battle, he slew the hideous monster Leviathan. That was the Canaanite stories. But then, look what David says. And this is just majestic. Verse 25. Here is the sea, great and wide, which teems with creatures innumerable. Living things go there, both small and great. There go the ships, and Leviathan, which you formed to play in it. Play in the sea. Brilliant. Playing. Leviathan and whatever other creatures lurk in the deep are just creatures that God has made. Verse 31. May the Lord rejoice in his works. He made them to play. No threat, no contest, no struggle. Or another one. One that is almost invisible to English-speaking readers, but crying out to the ancient Israelites in their world. Verse 6. When the people of Israel's world talked about how the world came to exist, they used to talk of a primeval struggle. They would tell stories of a great battle between the ancient gods, where the forces of chaos had to be fought down by warrior gods before anything could come to be. And the worst and the most frightening of the chaos gods was a monster called the Deep. It rode a chariot, and it carried something called the power weapon, and it was in league with beings with nice names like the Oogaloo demon, the rabid dog, and the scorpion man. But then look at the psalm. Look at the psalm, verse 5. He set the earth on its foundations. Then verse 6. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The mighty, frightening deep is just another part of God's creation. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains, shades of Genesis 1 there. And then in place of a great battle between the titans, there is verse 7. At your rebuke, they fled. There is evil in the universe in this psalm, but it's not a great hideous strength. It's tiny. It's no threat to God himself, and it's mostly embedded in humans. Dualism, good and evil powers in balance, light and dark sides of the force, it's just not there. There is God and there is his creation. And he is not threatened by it. Which brings us to the third and last thing. And back to that prowling lion. Look at the verb tenses here. Now, I know it's tough. It's the summer holidays and we're talking about grammar and all that. But look at the verbs. Verse 5. He set the earth on its foundations. Okay, that is in the past, isn't it? Past tense, the poetic beginning of everything. Verse 6, you covered it with the deep. That's the past too, way, way back. Verse 19, he made the moon to mark the seasons. Okay, that is the past. The moon is a bit old. So far, it could be just a version of what they call deism. You know, a distant, distant, distant kind of God, long, long, long ago, sets the dials and programs the universe, and off it goes. Like God in all eternity says, oh, this will be the amount of gravity in the universe, and this will be the weak nuclear interaction. Give it 100 trillion years, and then call time. But then look at the other verbs in the psalm. Verse 10, you make springs gush forth. Verse 13, you water the mountains. Verse 14, you cause the grass to grow. And on and on. In the present. See, the universe, the way that David talks about it, there is God and there's his creation, and he is not part of that creation, but he is involved with it in every detail. He doesn't need to mess with it or tinker with it or reprogram it all the time, but he runs it. So that the events in creation, the grass growing in verse 14, the grapes fermenting in verse 15, the darkness falling after sunset in verse 20, God does those things in every detail, all the time. So that old lion running down the zebra and biting into its neck, that is all the action of the lion, isn't it? It's the lion's muscles, the lion's cunning, the lion's terrible strength, and the lion's powerful teeth. And it is also the work of God in every detail. The biochemistry deep in the lion's cells turning glucose into action, the muscles contracting to bring those jaws together, those wonderful teeth meeting and doing the business. Every step, the lion seeks her food from God. And down in verse 28, he opens his hand and she is filled with good things. God completely involved. The lion completely involved. Or the wild donkey. Or the rock badger. Take your pick. This is a picture of a created world that God has not left on auto. He is running it. And not God as a far away impersonal force. Not God as the outcome of some philosophical discussion, but a person. Yahweh, the one who loves his people and has saved them. He is running it. Think of what you can do in a creation like that. Think of what you can do in a creation like the psalm describes. For one thing, you can pray. In this creation, it is worth praying. A God, an imaginary God locked in a struggle with equal and opposite forces, you never know whether he might be able to do anything to help you. Could be occupied in his battle with the dark side and he can't bother with you at the moment. A God who set the program running and then left it to go, not much point in praying. But a God like the one in this psalm. A God who is involved in his creation in every detail at every moment. That makes it well worth praying. And also, you can do science. You can do science in the universe of this psalm. You can learn and examine and study this created world and never be afraid that there will be some kind of threat to knowing God, because he is completely involved with the creation that you are studying. You're not going to study this universe and find some dreadful proof that he is not there. You're only going to find more and more depths to what a great place the created universe is. And you're not going to find anything that threatens God. No dark power that might take over. Even Leviathan is just there to play. Everything you learn about this created world and the way that it works is going to add to the way that you say verse 1. O Lord my God, you are very great. Every bit of physics, every subtle new discovery in biology, every bit of chemistry deep in the stars that we learn, every distant galaxy sending light from the early universe, every moment of pushing back the frontiers of ignorance adds to what David says here and gives us one more piece of, dear me, the universe is even bigger and more interesting than we dreamed. God's pretty great, isn't he? And then finally, what you can do with a creation like this, with a psalm like this, we can take a leaf out of David's book and just celebrate it. I mean, it really is rather good, isn't it? And celebrate God as its creator. The heavens, the sun, the moon, the valleys, the mountains, the lions, the rock badgers and things. Celebrate the lot in all its complexity and magnificence. And celebrate the God who made it as the one who is amazing enough to do all this. And even better than that, in all that power and wisdom, he is the one who gives you his love and his care and his goodness through Jesus. That God is the creator. Not bad. Really, not bad at all.